Chapter 29. Start with the kersey and finish with the thread. Migri Sow's luck continued. On her first day on the job as a castle servant, she was sent to deliver a spool of red thread to the princess.
"Mind," said the head of the serving staff, a dour woman named Louise, "she is royalty, so you must make sure you curtsy."
"How's that?"
shouted Mig.
"You must curtsy,"
shouted Louise.
"Gaw," said Mig.
"Yes'm."
She took the spool of thread from Louise and made her way up the golden stairs to the princess's room, talking to herself as she went.
"Here I am, off to see the princess. Me, Migri Sow, seeing the princess up close and personal-like. And first off, I must curtsy, because she is the royalty."
At the door to the princess's room, Mig had a sudden crisis of confidence. She stood a moment clutching the spool of thread and muttering to herself.
"Now, how did that go?" she said. "Give the princess the thread, and then give her a kersey. No, no. First the kersey and then the thread. That's it. Gaw, that's right. That's the order. Start with the kersey and finish with the thread."
She knocked at the princess's door.
"Enter,"
said the pea. Mig, hearing nothing, knocked again.
"Enter," said the pea.
And Mig, still hearing nothing, knocked yet again.
"Maybe," she said to herself, "the princess ain't to home."
But then the door was flung wide, and there was the princess herself, staring right at Migri Sow.
"Gaw,"
said Mig, her mouth hanging open.
"Hello," said the pea. "Are you the new serving maid? Have you brought me my thread?"
"Kersey, I must,"
shouted Mig.
She gathered her skirts, dropped the spool of thread, stuck a foot out, and stepped on the spool, rocked back and forth for what seemed like quite a long time, both to the watching princess and the rocking Mig, and finally fell to the floor with a Miggish thud.
"Whoopsie,"
said Migri Sow. The pea could not help it. She laughed.
"That's all right," she said to Mig, shaking her head. "It's the spirit of the thing that counts."
"How's that?"
shouted Mig.
"It's the spirit of the thing that counts," shouted P.
"Thank you, miss,"
said Mig. She got slowly to her feet. She looked at the princess. She looked down at the floor.
"First the kersey and then the thread,"
Mig muttered.
"Pardon,"
said the pea.
"Gaw," said Mig. "The thread!"
She dropped to her hands and knees to locate the spool of thread. When she found it, she stood back up and offered it to P.
"I brought you your thread, didn't I?"
"Lovely,"
said the princess as she took the thread from Mig. "Thank you so much. I cannot seem to hold on to a spool of red thread. Everyone I have disappears somehow."
"Are you making a thing?"
asked Mig, squinting at the cloth in the pea's hand.
"I am making a history of the world, my world,"
said the pea,
"in tapestry. See, here is my father, the king, and he's playing the guitar because that is something he loves to do and does quite well. And here is my mother, the queen, and she is eating soup, because she loved soup."
"Soup? Gaw, that's against the law."
"Yes," said the princess. "My father outlawed it because my mother died while she was eating it."
"Your ma's dead?"
"Yes,"
said the pea. "She died just last month." She bit her bottom lip to stop it from trembling.
"Ain't that the thing?"
said Mig.
"My ma's dead too."
"How old were you when she died?"
"Bold, was I?"
said Mig, taking a step back away from the princess.
"I'm sorry, then."
"No, no, how old? How old were you?" shouted the pea.
"Not but 6,
said Mig.
"I'm sorry," said the princess.
She gave Mig a quick, deep look of sympathy.
"How old are you now?"
12 years.
"So am I," said the princess. "We're the same age." "What is your name?" she shouted.
"Migri, Migri Sow, but most just calls me Mig. And I saw you once before, princess. You passed me by on a little white horse. On my birthday it was, and I was in the field with Uncle Sheep, and it was sunset time."
"Did I wave to you?" asked the princess.
"Eh?
Did I wave?" shouted the pea.
"Yes,"
nodded Mig.
"But you didn't wave back," said the princess.
"I did," said Mig, "only you didn't see. Some day I will sit on a little white horse and wear a crown and wave. Some day,"
said Mig, and she put up a hand to touch her left ear.
"I will be a princess too."
"Really?"
said the pea, and she gave Mig another quick, deep look, but said nothing else. When Mig finally made her way back down the golden stairs, Louise was waiting for her.
"How long," she roared, "did it take you to deliver a spool of thread to the princess?"
"Too long,"
guessed Mig.
"That's right,"
said Louise, and she gave Mig a good clout to the ear. "You are not destined to be one of our star servants. That is already abundantly clear."
"No, ma'am,"
said Mig.
"That's all right, though, because
I aim to be a princess. You, a princess? Don't make me laugh.
This, listener, was a little joke on Louise's part, as she was not a person who laughed. Ever. Not even at a notion as ridiculous as Miggery Sow becoming a princess. Chapter 30. To the Dungeon. At the castle, for the first time in her young life, Mig had enough to eat. And eat she did. She quickly became plump, and then plumper still. She grew rounder and rounder, and bigger. Only her head stayed small. Listener, as the teller of this tale, it is my duty from time to time to utter some hard and rather disagreeable truths. In the spirit of honesty, then, I must inform you that Mig was the tiniest bit lazy. And, too, she was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. That is, she was a bit slow-witted. Because of these shortcomings, Louise was hard-pressed to find a job that Miggery Sow could effectively perform. In quick succession, Mig failed as a lady-in-waiting. She was caught trying on the gown of a visiting duchess. A seamstress, she sewed the cloak of the riding-master to her own frock and ruined both. And as a chambermaid, sent to clean a room, she stood open-mouthed and delighted, admiring the gold walls and floors and tapestries, exclaiming over and over again, "Gaw! Ain't it pretty? Gaw! Ain't it something, then?" and did no cleaning at all. And while Mig was trying and failing at these many domestic chores, other important things were happening in the castle. The rat in the dungeon below was pacing and muttering in the darkness, waiting to take his revenge on the princess. And upstairs in the castle the princess had met a mouse, and the mouse had fallen in love with her. Will there be consequences? You bet. Just as Mig's inability to perform any job well had its consequences. For, finally, as a last resort, Louise sent Mig to the kitchen, where cook had a reputation for dealing effectively with difficult help. In cook's kitchen, Mig dropped eggshells in the pound cake batter. She scrubbed the kitchen floor with cooking oil instead of cleanser. She sneezed directly on the king's pork chop moments before it was to be served to him.
"Of all the good-for-nothings I have encountered," shouted cook, "surely you are the worst, the most cauliflower-eared, the good-for-nothingest. There's only one place left for you, the dungeon."
"Eh?"
said Mig, cupping a hand around her ear.
"You are being sent to the dungeon. You are to take the jailer his noonday meal. That will be your duty from now on."
Listener, you must know that the mice of the castle feared the dungeon. Must I tell you that the humans feared it too? Certainly, it was never far from their thoughts. In the warm months, a foul odour rose out of its dark depths and permeated the whole of the castle. And in the still, cold nights of winter, terrible howls issued from the dark place, as if the castle itself were weeping and moaning.
"It's only the wind," the people of the castle assured each other. "Nothing but the wind."
Many a serving girl had been sent to the dungeon bearing the jailer's meal, only to return white-faced and weeping, hands trembling, teeth chattering, insisting that they would never go back. And worse, there were whispered stories of those servant girls who had been given the job of feeding the jailer, who had gone down the stairs and into the dungeon, and who had never been seen or heard from again. Do you believe that this will be Mig's fate? Gore, I hope not. What kind of a story would this be without Mig?
"Listen, you cauliflower-eared fool," shouted cook. "This is what you do. You take the tray of food down to the dungeon, and you wait for the old man to eat the food, and then you bring the tray back up. Do you think you can manage that?"
I reckon so," said Mig. "I take the old man the tray, and he eats what's on it, and then I bring the tray back up. Empty, it would be then. I bring the empty tray back up from the deep downs."
"That's right," said cook. "Seems simple, don't it? But I'm sure you'll find a way to bungle it." "Eh?" said Mig.
"Nothing," said cook.
"Good luck to you. You'll be needing it."
She watched as Mig descended the dungeon stairs. They were the very same stairs, listener, that the mouse Despero had been pushed down the day before. Unlike the mouse, however, Mig had a light. On the tray with the food, there was a single flickering candle to show her the way. She turned on the stairs and looked back at cook and smiled.
"That cauliflower-eared, good-for-nothing fool," said cook, shaking her head.
What's to become of someone who goes into the dungeon smiling, I ask you?
Listener, for the answer to Cook's question, you must listen on.
Chapter 31
A Song in the Dark. The terrible foul odour of the dungeon did not bother Mig. Perhaps that is because, sometimes, when Uncle was giving her a good clout to the ear, he missed his mark and delivered a good clout to Mig's nose instead. This happened often enough that it interrupted the proper workings of Mig's olfactory senses. And so it was that the overwhelming stench of despair and hopelessness and evil was not at all discernible to her, and she went happily down the twisting and turning stairs.
"Gaw!" she shouted. "It's dark, ain't it?"
"Yes, it is, Mig," she answered herself.
"But if I was a princess, I would be so glittery light-like, there wouldn't be a place in the world that was dark to me."
At this point, Migory Sow broke into a little song that went something like this. "I ain't the Princess Pea, but some day I will be the Pea, ha-hee, some day I will be." Mig, as you can imagine, wasn't much of a singer, more of a bellower, really. But in her little song there was, to the rightly tuned ear, a certain kind of music. And as Mig went singing down the stairs of the dungeon, there appeared from the shadows a rat, wrapped in a cloak of red, and wearing a spoon on his head.
"Yes, yes," whispered the rat. "A lovely song. Just the song I have been waiting to hear."
And Roscuro quietly fell in step beside Mig Risau. At the bottom of the stairs, Mig shouted out into the darkness,
"Gaw! It's me, Migory Sow, most calls me Mig, delivering your food. Come and get it, Mr. Deep Downs."
There was no response. The dungeon was quiet, but it was not quiet in a good way. It was quiet in an ominous way. It was quiet in the way of small, frightening sounds. There was the snail-like slither of water oozing down the walls, and from around a darkened corner there came the low moan of someone in pain. And then, too, there was the noise of the rats going about their business, their sharp nails hitting the stones of the dungeon and their long tails dragging behind them through the blood and muck. Listener, if you were standing in the dungeon, you would certainly hear all of these disturbing and ominous sounds. If I were standing in the dungeon, I would hear these sounds. If we were standing together in the dungeon, we would hear these sounds, and we would be very frightened. We would cling to each other in our fear. But what did Migory Sow hear? That's right. Absolutely nothing. And so she was not afraid at all, not in the least. She held the tray up higher, and the candle shed its weak light on the towering pile of spoons and bowls and kettles.
"Gaw," said Mig, "look at them things. I ain't never imagined there could be so many spoons in the whole wide world."
"There is more to this world than anyone could imagine," said a booming voice from the darkness.
"True, true," whispered Roscuro. "The old jailer speaks true."
"Gaw," said Mig, "who said that?"
And she turned in the direction of the jailer's voice.
Chapter 32 Beware of the Rats.
The candlelight on Mig's tray revealed Gregory limping toward her, the thick rope tied around his ankle, his hands outstretched.
"You, Gregory presumes, have brought food for the jailer."
"Gaw," said Mig.
She took a step backward.
"Give it here,"
said Gregory, and he took the tray from Mig and sat down on an overturned kettle that had rolled free from the tower. He balanced the tray on his knees and stared at the covered plate.
"Gregory assumes that today, again, there is no soup."
"Eh?" said Mig.
"Soup!"
shouted Gregory.
"Illegal!"
shouted Mig back.
"Most foolish,"
muttered Gregory as he lifted the cover off the plate.
"Too foolish to be born, a world without soup."
He picked up a drumstick and put the whole of it in his mouth and chewed and swallowed.
"Here!"
said Mig, staring hard at him.
"You forgot the bones."
"Not forgotten. Chewed."
"Gaw,"
said Mig, staring at Gregory with respect.
"You eats the bones. You are most ferocious."
Gregory ate another piece of chicken, a wing, bones and all, and then another. Mig watched him admiringly.
"Some day,"
she said, moved suddenly to tell this man her deepest wish,
"I will be a princess."
At this pronouncement, Chiaroscuro, who was still at Mig's side, did a small, deliberate jig of joy. In the light of the one candle, his dancing shadow was large and fearsome indeed.
"Gregory sees you,"
Gregory said to the rat shadow. Roscuro ceased his dance. He moved to hide beneath Mig's skirts.
"Hey!"
shouted Mig.
"What's that?"
"Nothing," said Gregory. "So, you aim to be a princess? Well, everyone has a foolish dream. Gregory, for instance, dreams of a world where soup is legal. And that rat, Gregory is sure, has some foolish dream too."
"If only you knew," whispered Roscuro.
"What?"
shouted Mig. Gregory said nothing more. Instead, he reached into his pocket and then held his napkin up to his face and sneezed into it once, twice, three times.
"Bless you," shouted Mig. "Bless you, bless you."
"Back to the world of light," Gregory whispered.
And then he balled the napkin up and placed it on the tray.
"Gregory is done,"
he said, and he held the tray out to Mig.
"Done, are you? Then the tray goes back upstairs. Cook says it must. You take the tray to the deep downs, you wait for the old man to eat, and then you bring the tray back. Them's my instructions."
"Did they instruct you, too, to beware of the rats?"
"The what?"
"The rats."
"What about them?"
"Beware of them," shouted Gregory.
"Right," said Mig. "Beware the rats."
Roscuro, hidden beneath Mig's skirts, rubbed his front paws together.
"Warn her all you like, old man," he whispered. "My hour has arrived. The time is now, and your rope must break. No nibbling this time. Rather, a serious chew that will break it in two. Yes, it is all coming clear. Revenge is at hand."
Chapter 33. A Rat Who Knows Her Name. Mig had climbed the dungeon stairs and was preparing to open the door to the kitchen when the rat spoke to her.
"May I detain you for a moment?"
Mig looked to her left and then to her right.
"Down here,"
said Roscuro. Mig looked at the floor.
"Gaw," she said. "You're a rat, ain't you? And didn't the old man just warn me of such? Beware the rats," he said.
She held the tray up higher, so that the light from the candle shone directly on Roscuro, and the golden spoon on his head, and the blood-red cloak around his neck.
"There is no need to panic. None at all," said Roscuro.
As he talked, he reached behind his back, and using the handle, he raised the soup spoon off his head, much in the manner of a man lifting his hat to a lady.
"Gaw," said Mig. "A rat with manners."
"Yes," said Roscuro.
"How do you do?" "My papa had him some cloth much like yours, Mr. Rat," said Mig. "Red like that. He traded me for it."
"Ah," said Roscuro, and he smiled a large, knowing smile.
"Ah, did he really? That is a terrible story, a tragic story."
"Listener, if you will pardon me, we must pause for a moment to consider a great and unusual thing, a portentous thing. That great, unusual, portentous thing is this. Roscuro's voice was pitched perfectly to make its way through the tortuous path of Mig's broken-down cauliflower ears. That is to say, dear listener, Migory Sow heard, perfect and true, every single word the rat Roscuro uttered.
"You have known your share of tragedy," said Roscuro to Mig. "Perhaps it is time for you to make the acquaintance of triumph and glory."
"Triumph," said Mig. "Glory."
"Allow me to introduce myself," said Roscuro. "I am Chiaroscuro. Friends call me Roscuro. And your name is Migory Sow. And it is true, is it not, that most people call you simply Mig?"
"Ain't that the thing?" shouted Mig. "A rat who knows my name."
"Miss Migory, my dear, I do not want to appear too forward so early in our acquaintance, but may I inquire, am I right in ascertaining that you have aspirations?"
"What do you mean, aspirations?"
shouted Mig.
"Miss Migory, there is no need to shout. None at all. As you can hear me, so I can hear you. We two are perfectly suited, each to the other."
Roscuro smiled again, displaying a mouthful of sharp yellow teeth.
"Aspirations, my dear,
are those things that would make a serving girl wish to be a princess.
Gaw, agreed Mig. A princess is exactly what I want to be.
There is, my dear, a way to make that happen. I believe that there is a way to make that dream come true.
You mean that I could be the Princess P?
Yes, Your Highness, said Roscuro, and he swept the spoon off his head and bowed deeply at the waist. Yes, your most royal Princess P.
Gaw, said Mig.
May I tell you my plan? May I illustrate for you how we can make your dream of becoming a princess a reality?
Yes, said Mig. Yes.
It begins, said Roscuro, with yours truly, and the chewing of a rope.
Mig held the tray with the one small candle burning bright, and she listened as the rat went on, speaking directly to the wish in her heart. So passionately did Roscuro speak, and so intently did the serving girl listen, that neither noticed as the napkin on the tray moved. Nor did they hear the small, mouse-like noises of disbelief and outrage that issued from the napkin as Roscuro went on unfolding, step by step, his diabolical plan to bring the princess to darkness. End of the third book. Book the Fourth. Recalled to the Light. Chapter 34. Kill 'em, even if they's already dead. Listener, you did not forget about our small mouse, did you? Back to the light. That was what Gregory whispered to him when he wrapped Despero in his napkin and placed him on the tray. And then Mig, after her conversation with Roscuro, carried the tray into the kitchen, and when she saw Cook, she shouted,
"It's me, Miggery Sow, back from the deep downs."
"Ah, lovely," said Cook. "And ain't we all relieved?" Mig put the tray on the counter.
"Here, here," said Cook. "Your duties ain't done. You must clear it."
"How's that?"
shouted Mig.
"You must clear the tray," shouted Cook.
She reached over and took hold of the napkin and gave it a good shake, and Despero tumbled out of the napkin and landed right directly, plop, in a measuring cup full of oil.
"Ack," said Cook. "A mouse, in my kitchen, in my cooking oil, in my measuring cup. You, Mig, kill him, directly."
Mig bent her head and looked at the mouse slowly sinking to the bottom of the glass cup.
"Poor little Meesy," she said,
and she stuck her hand into the oil and pulled him out by his tail. Despero, gasping and coughing and blinking at the bright light, could have wept with joy at his rescue. But he was not given time to cry.
"Kill him," shouted Cook.
"Gaw," said Mig. "All right."
Holding Despero by the tail, she went to get the kitchen knife. But the mouse tail, covered as it was in oil, was slick and difficult to hold on to, and Mig, in reaching for the knife, loosened her grip, and Despero fell to the floor. Mig looked down at the little bundle of brown fur.
"Gaw," she said. "That killed him for sure."
"Kill him, even if he's already dead," shouted Cook. "That's my philosophy with mice. If they're alive, kill them. If they're dead, kill them. That way you can be certain of having yourself a dead mouse, which is the only kind of mouse to have."
"That's some good sophistry, that is. Kill 'em, even if they're already dead."
"Hurry, you cauliflower-eared fool," shouted Cook. "Hurry."
Despero lifted his head from the floor. The afternoon sun was shining through the large kitchen window. He had time to think how miraculous the light was, and then it disappeared, and Mig's face loomed into view. She studied him, breathing through her mouth.
"Little Meesy," she said, "ain't you going to skedaddle?"
Despero looked for a long moment into Mig's small, concerned eyes, and then there came a blinding flash and the sound of metal moving through the air as Mig brought the kitchen knife down, down, down. Despero felt a very intense pain in his hindquarters. He leapt up and into action. Listener, he scurried. He scurried like a professional mouse. He zigged to the left, he zagged to the right.
"Gaw!" shouted Mig. "Missed him!"
"Ain't that a surprise," said Cook, just as Despero scurried under a crack in the pantry door.
"I got the little Meesy's tail, though," said Mig.
She bent over and picked up Despero's tail and held it up, proudly displaying it to Cook.
"So," shouted Cook, What good will that do us when the rest of him has disappeared into the pantry?
I don't know, said Mig,
and she braced herself as Cook advanced upon her, intending to give her a good clout to the ear.
I don't know.
Chapter 35 The Knight in Shining Armour. Desborough was pondering the reverse of that question. He was wondering not what he would do with his tale, but what he would do without it. He was sitting on a bag of flour high atop a shelf in the pantry, crying for what he had lost. The pain in his hindquarters was intense, and he wept because of it. But he also cried because he was happy. He was out of the dungeon. He had been recalled to life. His rescue had happened just in time for him to save the Princess P from the terrible fate that the rat had planned for her. So Desborough wept with joy, and with pain, and with gratitude. He wept with exhaustion, and despair, and hope. He wept with all the emotions a young small mouse who had been sent to his death, and then been delivered from it in time to save his beloved, can feel. Listener, the mouse wept. And then he lay down on the sack of flour and slept. Outside the castle the sun set and the stars came out one by one, and then they disappeared and gave way to the rising sun, and still Desborough slept. And while he slept, he dreamt. He dreamt of the stained glass windows and the dark of the dungeon. In Desborough's dream the light came to life, brilliant and glorious, in the shape of a knight swinging a sword. The night fought the dark. And the dark took many shapes. First the dark was his mother, uttering phrases in French, and then the dark became his father, beating the drum. The dark was Furlough, wearing a black hood and shaking his head no. And the dark became a huge rat, smiling a smile that was evil and sharp.
The dark!
Desborough cried, turning his head to the left.
The light!
He murmured, turning his head to the right. He called out to the knight. He shouted,
Who are you? Will you save me?
But the knight did not answer him.
Tell me who you are, Desborough shouted.
The knight stopped swinging his sword. He looked at Desborough. You know me, he said.
No, said Desborough, I don't.
You do, said the knight. He slowly took the armour off his head and revealed nothing. No one. The suit of armour was empty.
No. Oh, no, said Desborough. There is no knight in shining armour. It's all just make-believe, like happily ever after.
And in his sleep, listener, the small mouse began to cry. Chapter 36 What Mig Carried. And while the mouse slept, Roscuro put his terrible plan into effect. Would you like to hear, listener, how it all unfolded? The story is not a pretty one. There is violence in it, and cruelty. But stories that are not pretty have a certain value too, I suppose. Everything, as you well know, having lived in this world long enough to have figured out a thing or two for yourself, cannot always be sweetness and light. Listen, this is how it happened. First, the rat finished once and for all the job he had started long ago. He chewed through Gregory's rope, all the way through it, so that the jailer became lost in the maze of the dungeon. Late at night, when the castle was dark, the serving girl Migri Sow climbed the stairs to the princess's room. In her hand she carried a candle, and in the pockets of her apron were two very ominous things. In the right pocket, hidden in case they should encounter anyone on the stairs, was a rat with a spoon on his head and a cloak of red around his shoulders. In the left pocket was a kitchen knife, the same knife that Migri Sow had used to cut off the tail of a certain mouse. These were the things, a rat and a knife and a candle, that Mig carried with her as she climbed up, up, up the stairs.
Gaw! She shouted to the rat. It's dark, ain't it?
Yes, yes, whispered Roscuro from her pocket. It is quite dark, my dear.
When I'm princess, began Mig.
Shh! Said Roscuro. May I suggest that you keep your glorious plans for the future to yourself? And may I further suggest that you keep your voice down to a whisper? We are, after all, on a covert mission. Do you know how to whisper, my dear?"
"I do,"
shouted Mig. "Then please," said Roscuro, "please institute this knowledge immediately."
"Gaw,"
whispered Mig.
"All right."
"Thank you," said Roscuro. "Do I need to review with you again our plan of action?"
"I got it all straight right here in my head,"
whispered Mig, and she tapped the side of her head with one finger.
"How comforting," said Roscuro. "Perhaps, my dear, we should go over it again, one more time, just to be sure."
"Well," said Mig, "we're going to the princess's room, and she will be sleeping and snoozing and snoring, and I will wake her up and show her the knife and say, 'If you does not want to get hurt, princess, you must come with me.'"
"And you will not hurt her," said Roscuro.
"No, I won't, because I want her to live so that she can be my lady-in-waiting when I become the princess."
"Exactly," said Roscuro. "That will be her divine comeuppance."
"Gaw,"
whispered Mig.
"Yes, her divine comeuppance."
Mig had, of course, no idea what the phrase divine comeuppance meant, but she very much liked the sound of it, and she repeated it over and over to herself until Roscuro said, "And then?"
"And then," continued Mig, "I tells her to get out of her princess bed and come with me on a little journey."
"Ah," said Roscuro, "a little journey. That is right. Ah, I love the understatement of that phrase, a little journey. Oh, it will be a little journey. Indeed it will."
"And then,"
said Mig, who was now coming to her favourite part of the plan,
"we take her to the deep downs, and we gives her some long lessons in how to be a serving girl, and we gives me some short lessons in how to be a princess, and when we is all done studying up, we switch places. I gets to be the princess, and she gets to be the maid. Gaw!"
Listener, this is the very plan that Roscuro presented to Mig when he first met her. It was, of course, a ridiculous plan. No one would ever, not for one blind minute, mistake Mig for the princess or the princess for Mig. But Migarisau, as I pointed out to you before, was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And, listener, too, she wanted so desperately to become a princess. She wanted, oh, how she wanted. And it was because of this terrible wanting that she was able to believe in Roscuro's plan with every ounce of her heart. The rat's real plan was, in a way, more simple and more terrible. He intended to take the princess to the deepest, darkest part of the dungeon. He intended to have Mig put chains on the princess's hands and her feet, and he intended to keep the glittering, glowing, laughing princess there in the dark. Forever. Chapter 37. A Small Taste. She was asleep and dreaming of her mother, the queen, who was holding out a spoon to her and saying,
"Taste this, my sweet pea, taste this, my darling, and tell me what you think."
The princess leaned forward and sipped some soup from the spoon her mother held out to her.
"Oh, mamma," she said, "it's wonderful. It's the best soup I have ever eaten." "Yes," said the queen, "it is wonderful, isn't it?"
"May I have some more?" said the pea.
"I gave you a small taste, so that you would not forget," said her mother. "I gave you a small taste, so that you would remember."
"I want more." But as soon as the princess said this, her mother was gone. She disappeared, and the bowl and the soup spoon disappeared along with her.
"Lost things," said the pea. "More lost things."
And then she heard her name. She turned, happy, thinking that her mother had come back. But the voice was not her mother's. The voice belonged to somebody else, and it was coming from some place far away, and it was telling her to wake up, wake up. The pea opened her eyes and saw Migarisau standing over her bed, a knife in one hand and a candle in the other.
"Mig," she said.
"Gaw,"
said Mig softly.
"Say it,"
commanded Roscuro. Mig closed her eyes and shouted her piece.
"If you does not want to get hurt, princess, you must come with me."
"Whatever for?" said the princess in an annoyed tone. As I have noted before, the princess was not a person who was used to being told what to do. "What are you talking about?"
Mig opened her eyes and shouted,
"You got to come with me, so after we take some lessons, you some long lessons and me some short ones, together way down in the deep downs, I can be you and you can be me."
"No,"
shouted Roscuro from Mig's pocket.
No, no, you are doing it wrong.
Who said that?
Your Highness, said Roscuro.
And he crawled out of Mig's pocket and made his way up to her shoulder and situated himself there, laying his tail across her neck to balance himself.
Your Highness, he said again.
And he raised the spoon slowly off his head and smiled, displaying his mouthful of truly hideous teeth.
I think it would be best if you do as Migri Sau suggests. She is, as you can quite clearly see, in possession of a knife, a large knife, and she will, if pushed, use it.
This is ridiculous, the princess said. You can't threaten me. I'm a princess.
We, said Roscuro, are all too aware of the fact of what you are. A knife, however, cares nothing for the fact that you are royalty. And you will bleed, I assume, just like any other human.
The pea looked at Mig. Mig smiled. The knife glinted in the light of the candle.
Mig, she said, her voice shaking the tiniest bit.
I really do not think, said Roscuro, that Mig would need much persuasion to use that knife, princess.
She is a dangerous individual, easily led.
But we are friends, said the pea. Aren't we, Mig?
Eh?
Said Mig.
Trust me, said Roscuro, you are not friends. And I think it would be best if you addressed all your communications to me, princess. I am the one in charge here. Look at me.
The pea looked directly at the rat and at the spoon on his head. Her heart skipped one beat and then two.
Do you know me, princess?
No, she said, lowering her head. I don't know you.
But listener, she did know him. He was the rat who had fallen in her mother's soup, and he was wearing her dead mother's spoon on his head. The princess kept her head down. She concentrated on containing the rage that was leaping up inside of her.
Look again, princess. Or can you not bear to look? Does it pain your royal sensibilities to let your eyes rest on a rat?
I don't know you, she said, and I'm not afraid to look at you.
The pea raised her head slowly. Her eyes were defiant. She stared at the rat.
Very well, said Roscuro. Have it your way. You do not know me. Nonetheless, you must do as I say, as my friend here has a knife. So, get out of bed, princess. We are going on a little journey. I would like it if you dressed in your loveliest gown, the one that you were wearing at a banquet not so long ago.
And put on your crown, said Mig. Put that on your princess' head.
Yes, said Roscuro. Please, princess, do not forget your crown.
The pea, still staring at Roscuro, pushed the covers back and got out of bed.
Move quickly, said Roscuro. We must take our little journey while it is still dark, and while the rest of the castle sleeps on. Ignorant, oh, so ignorant, I am afraid, of your fate.
The princess took a gown from her closet.
Yes, said Roscuro to himself. That is the one, the very one. Look at how it sparkles in the light.
Lovely.
I will need someone to do my buttons, said the princess, as she stepped into the dress. Mig, you must help me.
Little princess, said Roscuro, do you think that you can outsmart a rat? Our dear Migri Sau will not lay down her knife, not even for a moment. Will you, Migri Sau, because that might ruin your chances of becoming a princess? Isn't that right?
Go, said Mig, that's right.
And so while Mig held the knife pointed in the direction of the princess, the pea sat and let the rat crawl over her back, doing her buttons up for her, one by one. The princess held very still. The only movement she allowed herself was this. She licked her lips, over and over again, because she thought that she could taste there the sweet saltiness of the soup that her mother had fed her in her dream.
I have not forgotten, Mama, she whispered. I have not forgotten you. I have not forgotten soup.
Chapter 38. To the Dungeon. The strange threesome made their way down the golden stairs of the castle. The princess and Mig walked side by side, and Roscuro hid himself again in the pocket of Mig's apron, and Mig pointed the sharp tip of the knife at the princess's back, and together they went down, down, down. The princess was led to her fate, as around her everyone slept. The king slept in his giant bed, with his crown on his head, and his hands crossed on his chest, dreaming that his wife, the queen, was a bird, with green and gold feathers, who called his name, Philip, 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 without ceasing. Cook slept in a too small bed off the kitchen, dreaming of a recipe for soup that she could not find. "Where did I put that?" she mumbled in her sleep. "Where did that recipe go? It was for the Queen's favourite soup. I must find it." And not far from Cook, in the pantry, atop a bag of flour, slept the mouse, Despero, dreaming, as you know, listener, of knights in shining armour, of darkness and of light. And in the whole of the darkened, sleeping castle there was only the light of the candle in the hand of Migri Sow. The candle shone on the princess's dress and made it sparkle, and the princess walked tall in the light and tried not to be afraid. In this story, listener, we have talked about the heart of the mouse, and the heart of the rat, and the heart of the serving girl, Migri Sow. But we have not talked about the heart of the princess. Like most hearts, it was complicated, shaded with dark and dappled with light. The dark things in the princess's heart were these: a very small, very hot, burning coal of hatred for the rat who was responsible for her mother's death, and the other darkness was a tremendous sorrow, a deep sadness that her mother was dead, and that the princess could now only talk to her in her dreams. And what of the light in the princess's heart? Listener, I am pleased to tell you that the pea was a kind person, and perhaps more important, she was empathetic. Do you know what it means to be empathetic? I will tell you. It means that when you are being forcibly taken to a dungeon, when you have a large knife pointed at your back, when you are trying to be brave, you are able still to think for a moment of the person who is holding that knife. You are able to think, "Oh, poor Mig, she wants to be a princess so badly, and she thinks that this is the way. Poor, poor Mig, what must it be like to want something that desperately?" That, listener, is empathy. And now you have a small map of the princess's heart. Hatred, sorrow, kindness, empathy. The heart that she carried inside her as she went down the golden stairs and through the kitchen, and finally, just as the sky outside the castle began to lighten, down into the dark of the dungeon with the rat and the serving girl. Chapter 39. Missing. The sun rose and shed light on what Roscuro and Migri Sow had done. And finally Despero awoke. But alas, he awoke too late.
"I haven't seen her," Louise was shouting, "and I tell you I wash my hands of her. If she's missing, I say good riddance to bad rubbish."
Despero sat up. He looked behind him.
"Oh, his tail! Gone! Given over to the knife, and where the tail should be, nothing but a bloody stub."
"And more foul play. Gregory dead," shouted Cook.
"Poor old man. That rope of his broken by who knows what, and him lost in the dark and frightened to death because of it. It's too much."
"Oh, no," whispered Despero. "Oh, no. Gregory is dead."
The mouse got to his feet and began the long climb down from the shelf. Once he was on the floor, he stuck his head around the door of the pantry and saw Cook standing in the centre of the kitchen, wringing her fat hands. Beside her stood a tall woman jangling a ring of keys.
"That's right," said Louise. "All the king's men was down there searching for her in the dungeon, and when they come back up, who do they have with them? They have the old man, dead. And now you tell me that Mig is missing, and I say, who cares?"
Despero made a small noise of despair. He had slept too long. The rat had already acted. The princess was gone.
"What kind of world is it, Miss Louise, where princesses are taken from right under our noses and queens drop dead, and we cannot even take comfort in soup?"
And with this, Cook started to cry.
"Shh," said Louise. "I beg you, do not say that word." "Soup," shouted Cook. "I will say it. No one can stop me. Soup, soup, soup."
And then she began to cry in earnest, wailing and sobbing.
"There," said Louise. She put a hand out to touch Cook, and Cook slapped it away.
"It will be all right," said Louise.
Cook brought the hem of her apron up to wipe at her tears.
"It won't," she said. "It won't be all right ever again. They've taken our little darling away. There ain't nothing left to live for without the princess."
Despero was amazed to have exactly what was in his heart spoken aloud by such a ferocious, mouse-hating woman as Cook. Louise again reached out to touch Cook, and this time Cook allowed her to put an arm around her shoulder.
"What will we do? What will we do?"
wailed Cook. And Louise said, "Shh! There, there." Alas, there was no one to comfort Despero. And there was no time, anyway, for him to cry. He knew what he had to do. he had to find the king. For having heard Roscuro's plan, listener, Despero knew that the princess was hidden in the dungeon, and, being somewhat smarter than Migri Sow, he sensed the terrible unspoken truth behind Roscuro's words. He knew that Mig could never be a princess, and he knew that the rat, once he captured the pea, would never let her go. And so the small mouse, who had been dipped in oil, covered in flour, and relieved of his tail, slipped out of the pantry and past the weeping ladies. He went to find the king. Chapter 40 Forgiveness. He went first to the throne room, but the king was not there, and so Despero slipped through a hole in the moulding and was making his way to the princess's room when he came upon the mouse council, 13 mice and one most very honoured head mouse, sitting around their piece of wood debating important mouse matters. Despero stopped and stood very still.
"Fellow honoured mice," said the most very honoured head mouse, and then he looked up from the makeshift table and saw Despero.
"Despero," he whispered. The other mice of the council leaned forward, straining to make some sense of the word that the head mouse had just uttered.
"Pardon," one said.
"Excuse me," said another.
"I didn't hear right," said a third. "I thought you said Despero."
The head mouse gathered himself. He tried speaking again.
"Fellow members," he said, "a ghost, a ghost!"
And he raised a shaking paw and pointed it at Despero. The other mice turned and looked. And there was Despero Tilling, covered in flour, looking back at them, the telltale red thread still around his neck, like a thin trail of blood.
"Despero," said Lester, "son, you have come back."
Despero looked at his father and saw an old mouse whose fur was shot through with grey. How could that be? Despero had been gone only a few days, but his father seemed to have aged many years in his absence.
"Son, ghost of my son," said Lester, his whiskers trembling. "I dream about you every night. I dream about beating the drum that sent you to your death. I was wrong. What I did was wrong."
"No," called the most very honoured head mouse. "No."
"I've destroyed it," said Lester. "I have destroyed the drum. Will you forgive me?"
He clasped his front paws together and looked at his son.
"No," shouted the head mouse again. "No. Do not ask the ghost to forgive you, Lester. You did as you should. You did what was best for the mouse community."
Lester ignored the head mouse.
"Son," he said, "please."
Despero looked at his father, at his grey streaked fur and trembling whiskers and his front paws clasped together in front of his heart, and he felt suddenly as if his own heart would break in two. His father looked so small, so sad.
"Forgive me," said Lester again.
Forgiveness, listener, is, I think, something very much like hope and love. A powerful, wonderful thing. And a ridiculous thing, too. Isn't it ridiculous, after all, to think that a son could forgive his father for beating the drum that sent him to his death? Isn't it ridiculous to think that a mouse could ever forgive anyone for such perfidy? But still, here are the words Despero Tilling spoke to his father. He said, "I forgive you, Pa." And he said those words because he sensed that it was the only way to save his own heart, to stop it from breaking in two. Despero, listener, spoke those words to save himself. And then he turned from his father and spoke to the whole mouse council.
"You were wrong," he said, "all of you. You asked me to renounce my sins. I ask you to renounce yours. You wronged me. Repent."
"Never," said the head mouse.
Despero stood before the mouse council, and he realized that he was a different mouse than he had been the last time he faced them. He had been to the dungeon and back up out of it. He knew things that they would never know. What they thought of him, he realized, did not matter. Not at all. And so, without saying another word, Despero turned and left the room. After he was gone, the head mouse slapped his trembling paw on the table.
"Mice of the council," he said, "we have been paid a visit by a ghost who has told us to repent. We will now take a vote. All in favour of saying that this visit did not occur, vote aye."
And from the members of the mouse council there came a tiny but emphatic chorus of ayes. Only one mouse said nothing. That mouse was Despero's father. Lester Tilling had turned his head away from the other members of the mouse council. He was trying to hide his tears. He was crying, listener, because he had been forgiven.